from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Vic Viner spent 6 days on the beach at Dunkirk when Allied soldiers were trapped there by the German army in 1940. Viner was in the Royal Navy. He was a beachmaster. His job was to try and make some order of that chaos and get panicky and desperate men on boats to be evacuated. The film director Christopher Nolan talked with Viner as he was writing his film about Dunkirk, and Viner told the filmmaker he wasn't going to be able to capture what it was really like. You had to have been there, he said. Well, Nolan has done his best to portray the evacuation, and his film is now in theaters, which is giving us an opportunity to set the stage. We'll talk about the story of Dunkirk, the strategy, the personal stories, and let's not forget the British civilians in small boats who helped save the day. Join us after the news.
Take Radio West wherever you go with KUER's mobile app for Android and iPhone. Public radio is always a swipe away with KUER's mobile app, free and available for download right now in your mobile phone's app store.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Look, if you're a film director and you're making a war movie, you're going to want to show the most dramatic moments. And in the story of the evacuation of Dunkirk in 1940, there are plenty of these moments. The German army had trapped British, French, Belgian, Polish, Dutch soldiers, nearly 350,000 of them on a stretch of beach. They were sitting ducks, so there were plenty of stories of courage and of cowardice for the filmmaker Christopher Nolan to choose from. Nolan's film Dunkirk is now out in theaters, and if you've seen it, you would have seen the undramatic stuff too, like British officers with clipboards trying to cobble together hundreds of small civilian ships to sail across the channel to help in the rescue. Not as dramatic, of course, this part of the operation, but crucial to the outcome. We're talking speedboats and pleasure boats and car ferries and trawlers and drifters. Today in the program, we're going to try and set the stage for the events now being brought back to mind by Nolan's film. And I should say, we won't have any real spoilers from the film, though if you don't know the outcome of the story of Dunkirk, you may want to skip the show, at least for now. Joining us throughout the hour is John Broich. He is a British Empire historian and associate professor at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. He's written about Dunkirk since the film's release. He's currently working on a book about World War II in the Middle East. He's joining us today from Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul. And John Broich, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Doug. Thanks.
Also with us throughout the hour is Matthew Booker. He's an associate professor of history at North Carolina State University. He's been lecturing lately on public memory of war in Dunkirk, and he's joining us from Houston Pacifica Radio in Texas. Matthew Booker, welcome to you.
Good morning.
I guess I want to begin, Matthew Booker, let me ask you first, since you've been thinking about memory and public memory of war, what do you think Americans know about the story of Dunkirk? I mean, they're about to know a lot more, obviously. The movie's pretty popular. But before all of that started, what do you think, forget Europe for now, what do you think we knew for the most part about Dunkirk?
Well, less than I thought. This conversation I had in Raleigh last week really opened my eyes, because I grew up with the story of Dunkirk as one of the great heroic war myths of World War II. And I think that's because I was, like many boys and young men, obsessed with war as a child. But it turns out that I think for many Americans, Dunkirk fades into the story of a sort of prelude to the real war, which for Americans often begins with, of course, with Pearl Harbor, but the heroism part often starts at D-Day. So Americans often think of D-Day, I think, as the crucial beginning of the war and the end of the war. And I think what this film does so powerfully is to remind us of the essential background, and in fact, to undermine, frankly, the critical aspects of D-Day.
John Broich, what do you think about the way Americans thought about all of this before there was this blockbuster movie that's apparently so popular?
Yeah, I think Matthew put it really well. That really jives with what I hear from undergraduates, too. It's sort of an eye-opening for them to realize that Britain and the Commonwealth were fighting this war for a better part of a year before the Americans got in. And, you know, from Dunkirk onward, it's a life or death fight for Britain to hold on until Roosevelt can get America into the war. Would you say that's right, Matthew, that Churchill is waiting for Roosevelt to be able to convince the American people to get into this war from that point?
I'm so struck by that final line, the final lines of Churchill's extraordinary speech to the House of Commons on June 4th, 1940, when he's reflecting on the Dunkirk evacuation and beginning a critical story, right? He's telling a story to the British people and the people of the world. And as the son, of course, of an American woman, he has this close relationship with the United States. And he says he hopes that they can hold on until the new world can come to the rescue of the old.
That's right.
We're going to play that. I actually want to work our way to it. But let me just quote it. Churchill talks about how we will carry on this struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to rescue and the liberation of the old. And that's what he means. Is that what he has in mind? It sounds so poetic and lovely, but is he referring to, I guess it can't be anything else. Is it America he's talking about?
I think it is.
Well, I think,
John,
so too. Matthew, you know what Roosevelt was up to and trying to gear up for this war. But I think it's unmistakable that he means we will hold out or we will survive. In the case of invasion, we will survive until the Americans and the Canadians come to our rescue. Now, we're gonna, as Doug said, we're going to talk about that a little bit later, but he gives a little bit of a short shrift to the Empire and the Commonwealth in the words just preceding that, because it turns out that it's India that keeps Britain in the fight until the Americans can come over.
Yeah. Broadly, what were the stakes for Dunkirk? I mean, what was at stake at that moment in the war?
Well, what's clearly at stake is the ability of the British, of Great Britain proper, not the Empire, as John so correctly points out.
Right.
Can't wait for that part. But what's clearly at stake is the ability of the Allies to wage offensive war on land. And, when we imagine war, particularly through war films, what we often think of historically, or in the past, I should say, is we imagine men in rooms with maps. We see generals moving markers around. We have this 30,000-foot view. But the war is a matter of individuals, of groups of individuals doing their best under trying circumstances. And the infantry is the backbone of any military force. And that's what was at stake for Great Britain, was its infantry.
Where are we in the spring of 1940? The war, of course, is in its early stages, very early stages. And at this point, I suppose it doesn't look so good for the Allies.
I think that is very fair to say.
Yeah.
In fact, that marvelous speech that Churchill gives, which is truly one of the great pieces of war. I was going to call it propaganda, which is a harsh word, but I think it's not wrong. It's a matter of convincing the British people and also the Americans, frankly, and the rest of the Empire to stick with or to join Great Britain. Where they're at in spring of 1940 is after a great deal of dithering, the Allies, that is to say, the great combination of France, which is the greatest military power coming out of World War I. We often forget they are the ones who really won World War I with their blood and their labors. And their great allies, the British, they finally declare war on Germany, after the invasion of Poland. And for most of the fall and winter, there's the so-called phony war, when not a whole lot of aggressive action occurs between the powers. In fact, Germany may have attempted even to end the war through some kind of negotiations at that point. They're hoping not really to. They were surprised, supposedly, that the Allies come in. But that all changes in April with a series of sharp engagements in Norway and Denmark, mostly disasters for the Allies. And then, of course, on May 10th, when German columns burst into simultaneously into Belgium, Holland, and France. And while the Allies are not unprepared, not surprised by this invasion, they are caught off guard by the enormous power of massed armor that the Germans push into and then slice through. And that just sends all of the Allies' plans for a slow retreat and retrenchment and counterattack up in smoke overnight.
That's right on. Very well said. I mean, it was supposed to be a repeat of World War One, a slugfest along this line, except now we have these the fortresses along the Maginot Line. And the Germans roll the dice on this tricky maneuver, this charge through the Ardennes region, and
it pays off.
Snake eyes. It pays off. and it's you know, we remember this as a failure of the French army, what have you, but it's really this amazing stroke by the Germans.
How powerful was the German army? It seems like the Allies were cut off. I mean, you have these panzers, you have this new kind of technology, and I'm wondering if anyone was expecting at least that level of power.
Well, they had learned something in Poland about Blitzkrieg, and they had they were placing their bets on this tactic of combined arms and mobile warfare. Their tanks had wireless sets in them, and they could combine efforts between the tanks, between officers, and between the air. Whereas the British and French were not very good at those tactics, so it was an even match in terms of numbers on the ground, roughly. But the Germans were playing this game of mobile warfare very well.
You've said at this point, John, that Hitler didn't necessarily think he was going to have to devote much of his attention to Britain, just kind of wanted them out of the fight, figured maybe it might have even been easy.
Exactly. That's really what he's playing for here. We will take the British out of the fight, and when they come to terms for us, we're not going to crush them. This is all very twisted stuff in the mind of Hitler. We're going to have them continue their role as a sort of world police under us. So we're not going to destroy them. We consider them to be decent Aryans. So it's all very dark. But he's not imagining obliterating the British. And you know, this is. Again, like I say, it's very twisted stuff because he's hopeful about British democracy. Remember the context. Neville Chamberlain, his government was taken down in a vote of no confidence from the House of Commons at the end of the first week of May, in large part because of his conduct of the fight for Norway against the Germans. It was very costly and it was lost, and it didn't pay off. So that was the end of Neville Chamberlain and his government. Remember, nobody votes for prime minister in Britain. Yeah.
He's seen as the great appeaser.
You know, when we get back to that speech, the Churchill speech of the end of the first week of June, you can't imagine Chamberlain giving that speech. Okay, so that's what it takes to take down a government in Britain, that the party in power says we cannot be led by this person. So what Hitler might be imagining is, I will crush the British Expeditionary Force, and the logical outcome is for the people and the members of Parliament in Britain to take down Churchill. He'll be replaced by a peace party, maybe headed by Oswald Mosley, the British fascist, who knows? And the British will come to terms with me. That's the hope for Hitler.
It's interesting, Matthew Booker, you talk about how Churchill, after Dunkirk, he kind of uses that as the foundation to create this myth of British resolve. In some ways, this is where we get the stiff, or at least this is one of the places where we get this sort of stiff upper lip of the Brits.
Yes, Churchill is an extraordinary figure in world history, and he's a reminder that sometimes individuals and personalities can be extraordinarily important in the conduct and in the consequences of human affairs. That speech and that series of speeches that he gives in May and in early June, mid-June, are remarkable because he is constructing, I think, a story for the British people and, as we said, for the future allies he hopes to gain. But he's also, of course, building a story in contrast to another one which is very much on the ground and at the moment. And that's a story about an alternative story, equally plausible, about the utter failure of the Allies, which he acknowledges to his credit in his speech. But also, and I think more, and this is darker, a story about the abandonment of the French, to a lesser extent, their other allies, by the British, and their escape back to Britain. Because after all, the Dunkirk evacuation is going to disproportionately benefit, save, rescue British troops. And I think this is really important to remember because as historians, what we try to do, and as John just so beautifully, brilliantly did in his description of the Blitzkrieg, is to remind people of what things were like at the time, to recover that sense of uncertainty, because only in hindsight is Dunkirk, of course, a victory.
Yeah.
Only with hindsight can we see it as the beginning of the defeat of the German Empire. But that's exactly what Churchill is starting to do, and he's setting up an alternative to the absolute despair that the French feel.
Let me play a moment. This is from Churchill's speech at the House of Commons, June 4th of 1940. We know the outcome of Dunkirk at this point, but he, as you hear, Churchill says he may have had to deliver a very different speech.
When a week ago today, Mr. Speaker, I asked the House to fix this afternoon as the occasion for a statement, I feared it would be my hard lot to announce the greatest military disaster in our long history. I thought, and some good judges agreed with me, that perhaps 20 or 30,000 men might be re-embarked. But it certainly seemed that the whole of the French First Army and the whole of the British Expeditionary Force north of the Amiens-Abbeville Gap would be broken up in the open field, or else would have to capitulate for lack of food and ammunition. These were the hard and heavy tidings for which I called upon the House and the nation to prepare themselves a week ago.
I love that part because that's probably, in some ways, he was preparing a very different speech. John Broich?
Oh, absolutely. And everyone had every reason to expect that that was the speech that he was going to give.
Yeah.
This really is a surprise.
All right. I want to take a break and then we can get to Dunkirk. I want you to, gentlemen, to give us a setting of what's going on because the stories are of courage and, of course, of some cowardice, too. Certainly people panicked. It's really an extraordinary setting, and I want to get to it when we get back from a break. John Broich, an historian at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, is with us. Matthew Booker is also with us. He teaches history at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. I should also mention you can go to our website where you can find links to John Broich's two articles, an interview with Booker, along with links to some of these oral histories from the Imperial War Museum. We're going to be playing some moments from soldiers who were there a little bit later in the program. We'll take a break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the evacuation of Dunkirk, and you can probably guess why. Christopher Nolan's feature film, Dunkirk, is now in theaters. It gives us a chance to set the stage for this dramatic story. We're talking about how more than 300,000 Allied troops ended up stranded, really desperate, on a stretch of beach in France. John Broich is with us, an historian at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. Matthew Booker teaches history at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. So, John Broich, let me ask you, how did these hundreds of thousands of soldiers end up on this beach? Why was Dunkirk one of the options?
Right. Well, that's just a practical matter of after the German amazing stroke of getting through the Ardennes and the Belgians and the French and the British not being able to stop them there, and the Germans drive then to the channel. Well, as May wears on and the head of the British Expeditionary Force in France, Lord Gort, realizes that this is a disaster. Yeah. He simply looks for the most practicable port for getting the troops out of there. And the answer is Dunkirk. Yeah. And to a lesser extent, Calais, just to the north, although that's under greater German pressure. So we're going to have to evacuate. Where can we do this? The answer is Dunkirk. Now, it's not a great place to embark troops. It's a very broad beach, very shallow water. There is a jetty. And what they end up doing is using these moles to get the troops out. So it's not a great option, but it's just what makes sense.
Yeah. When did they realize they were trapped? I mean, I suppose they knew that was the case, but they were sitting ducks. Did they know that was going to be the case, at least until they could get them off of that beach?
Yes, they weren't under any illusions about the defensibility of Dunkirk, famous for its broad and long beach, not great anti-aircraft provision there at all, and the only reason they're able to hold out there as long as they did is because of the rear guard action of some very brave French soldiers along with some British soldiers, and the slight hesitation of the Germans in driving their panzers down to the beach.
Let me ask you, before we get to what it might have been like, which is probably difficult to convey if you weren't there, but it looks as though the German army has all the momentum. I mean, it seems as like they could land that coup de grace, you know, the final blow. But Hitler endorses an order to halt, which in retrospect seems like a huge mistake.
Yes, he endorsed an order to halt. Now, this was just over a couple days.
Yeah.
Thankfully, a couple days, because it made a big difference. But you have to again recall the Germans can hardly believe their luck in driving across northern France, and they can't allow their tanks to get way out ahead of all their support. The trucks with bearing infantry, artillery, and so on. They've been relying on dive bombers to provide their artillery, but they can't let themselves get isolated way ahead of the German army, or they'll be easily flanked. The British and French will realize that the tanks are isolated, and they'll flank them, and it'll be a very different story. So we, you know, our sort of high school training in this, and Matthew could probably speak to that. Our high school training in this is that Hitler was arrogant and wanted the Luftwaffe to show its strength, and he paid for it. Well, it's not exactly that simple. It's about supply lines and pace and letting everything catch up, and then we'll land the coup de grace and drive the Allies into the sea.
As you mentioned, the order would be rescinded and the German troops would start pounding away again soon. But this gave the Allied soldiers as you say, thankfully, enough time to sort themselves out at least a bit, to start building these defenses, those kinds of things. That seems
exactly
important, right?
Yep. That's right. It let the Allies sort themselves out to dig in, and it did make a big difference. Those 2 days did make a big difference.
Matthew Booker, and I'll get you on this too, John Boyk, but what was it like? They're sitting ducks in some ways. I keep saying that, but it just seemed like that, having seen the film myself and trying to imagine what it was like. You're there on a stretch of beach, and you've got these dive bombers coming at you from time to time. You don't know when. What was it like, do you figure? How difficult is it to convey that?
Well, this is the genius, of course, of film. And it's why we're so fortunate to live in a time when directors are willing and able to deliver, particularly given the technical aspects of this film, right? The fact that it's filmed with IMAX cameras in extremely high definition with this 70-millimeter technology. One thing that, and the sound, if you're able to see this in a theater, with an IMAX setup, you'll get this overwhelming score and soundtrack. And I think that's important because the experience of war that I mentioned before in sort of old-fashioned war movies is something we can handle. It's exciting and it's thrilling, but it's not, I think, anything like the absolute chaos and despair and desperation that real war appears to actually carry with it. And I think the only way to get some sense of that is to speak to or listen to veterans who've actually been in combat. And this is why the notion of bravery and cowardice begins to fall apart a little bit when we think about actual war. So much of military training is trying to get people to do things that are unnatural, to obey in conditions which should not rationally, in which you should not rationally do the thing you're being ordered to do. And that is why I so appreciate this film. I guess we're not going to give away too many spoilers, but I don't think it's a big surprise to say that the director brilliantly captures the fact that heroism at Dunkirk was just surviving. To survive was to be a hero. It's also true that many French men in particular died to protect the beachheads. That's another kind of heroism. But just surviving, I think, was true heroism.
Let me play a few moments from these extraordinary oral histories. This is Hugh Spencer Dundas. He's a British pilot with the RAF. And he describes this very confused scene, what the beach looked like from the air, I guess, from his Spitfire. Here's a moment.
A very significant aspect of the whole Dunkirk affair, from the Royal Air Force point of view, was that it was a very confused scene. There was this enormous great pall of smoke which was rising up from, I think, some oil tanks which had been set on fire, but there was a huge black pillar of smoke that came up and spread out and then leveled off and went down the channel for a distance of 7,500 miles. And underneath that, there was a lot of haze and general mayhem. And it was altogether a very confusing scene. Cloud, smoke. I think that's one of the reasons why perhaps the army had the impression that the Royal Air Force wasn't there half the time, because one there was no control. We were outside the range of our own radar. We just had to go there, and all the time one was playing a game with blind man's buff, so to speak. Very often one wasn't at the right height, and of course the Germans were operating from fields which were comparatively close, and they could come in and out very quickly. And there was an awful lot of luck as to whether one was in the right place at the right time.
There's a moment in the film I wanted to ask you both about where, after the evacuation, some of the soldiers see a British pilot and they say, "Where the hell were you?" I guess that's a little bit of what Dundas is getting at, which was, I guess was a real sentiment, John Boyk?
Oh, absolutely. If anything, the film understates it. Huh. But based on my reading and listening to these interviews, soldiers were livid because of that sort of animal fear that they seemed to experience being subject to strafing and bombing. And Matthew put it so well, given the sound and filming of this, the film does give you some sense of that terror. 1%, even 1% of the actual terror that the men and boys experienced is really something. So yes, Nolan is really capturing something that is well documented in the sources there.
There's another moment in the film, Matthew Booker, I wanted to ask you about, where a soldier just gives up and walks into the waves, which is an act of, you know, suicide or desperation. I guess these kinds of moments happened in the chaos of the moment.
Yes, another one of the of those interviews done a decade or more ago pulls out at least one example of men seeing others giving up. And John pointed me actually to those interviews in one of his online pieces. And I think what's remarkable even in that interview is the soldier who's telling the story of seeing someone walk into the ocean and disappear says he doesn't know. He doesn't really know what motivated that man to do that. Maybe he was trying to swim across the channel. Maybe he was committing suicide. That is what I meant about the unknowability and the chaos of these extraordinary moments that we call war and sort of gloss over.
Let me play another moment, which gives you a real sense of the desperation and the chaos. This is Arthur Williams Jocelyn. He's a British civilian who was on a barge that aided in the evacuation. And he talks about how, men were really desperate, and it was hard to maintain a sense of order.
They were, not used to boats, so you could see that. And, of course, they all stood up, all, rushing to try and get on board. The boat was could have capsized any moment. Anyway, there was an officer there, and he stood up in the bows there, and he got his revolver out, and he said, "I'll shoot the first man," he said, that makes a move until I give you... permission to get on board. And he said, "You'll do it in an orderly manner." And he stood there with his revolver, so that if they did disobey, we got them all on board. Well, I think there was quite a number of them there. I think it must have been nearly 50 in this boat. I mean, they were so packed up with them. And, of course, they were in such a state that they, wherever they were, they just lay down and slept. They were sorrowful. And I remember a couple of them, he picked up their rifles and threw them overboard and said, "We shan't want these anymore." The soldiers. "We shan't want these anymore," he said, and he threw them overboard. So I don't know what sort of state of mind they were in, but I mean, certainly they weren't very happy about things.
What an understatement there at the end. But that does give you a sense of it, right? I mean, the throwing the rifles overboard, exhaustion, relief, wondering. They must have been wondering how people were going to accept them if they were. I mean, this was a big idea in the film as well. John Broich, say something about that, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. There's no question. There's a lot of evidence of these soldiers feeling that they had taken part in something shameful. That they were going home as losers, and that they should expect to be treated as such when they get home. One of the characters in the film says that we'll be spat upon in the streets, and we read about that across the sources, and we know that the reality was much different from that.
Matthew, you want to say anything more about that?
Yeah, I think it's worth remembering here the context for how those British soldiers felt and how the public responded. And that is that, you know, this wasn't the first terrible global war that these generations had known. World War I is the great shadow over all of the activities of the 20s and 30s and of the end of World War II.
And not long before this, of course.
That's right. Yeah. It's within living memory. And so these are families, and the film brings that out in at least one of its characters. That sense of survival as being, again, a positive is one aspect of it. The other is that in World War I, cowardice was a capital offense on the battlefield, and you could be shot to death. So there is a these were boys who had grown up with stories of men marching into battle and dying.
Let me play another moment. Go ahead, John, before we...
Well, and Matthew is getting at this. These are inexperienced people. Some of the officers are World War I veterans, but not the boys and young men. And a lot of them are what they called Saturday soldiers. They were territorial army, sort of what we'd call reservists, who trained on Saturdays at being a gunner, what have you, called one another by first name, even their officers. It was a little bit of a lark for them. And they were thrown into this war that came upon them so suddenly in the spring and were outmatched strategically by the Germans and ran for their lives to Dunkirk, abandoning their equipment, running out of food and water and fuel. And so as terror descended upon them, they were hungry. They weren't at their best on top of everything else.
Here's a moment from Harry Garrett is his name. He's a British gunner, was there at Dunkirk.
On the train you went and got all this lovely food from these people, sandwiches, lovely cakes, and because when you're young at 21, you could eat anything. And smoking, because I smoked in those days, unfortunately. And away we went on this train, and it ended up in Staffordshire, Rugeley, in a beautiful town. Oh, it's a lovely place. And eventually we went to Cannock Chase, where there's a transit camp there, which was a 1418 war camp, I believe. But the people in that town were so marvellous. Well, we were heroes, but you know, you weren't really heroes, you were defeated. I didn't need much people talk to me before I cried my eyes out. I couldn't believe that we as British were defeated by the Germans without any help from anybody else. We just weren't good enough for them. At least they were overwhelming us. And it was a very tearsome time, because every time anybody spoke to me, I used to burst out with, silly tears.
Terry Garrett, this was recorded in 2004. You can find a link, by the way, to some of these oral histories from the Imperial War Museums on our website, radiowest.org. We have John Broich with us. We have Matthew Booker with us. We'll take another quick break and come back in just a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the evacuation of Dunkirk. We have with us John Broich, an historian at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, and Matthew Booker, who teaches history at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. I mentioned we have links to these oral histories we've been playing from the Imperial War Museums on our website, radiowest.org. I'm trying to imagine, gentlemen, what would have happened if they hadn't been able to evacuate. I guess at some point they would have had to surrender. That option clearly was on the minds of some officials. What would have happened? John Broich?
Yeah. Historians don't know. but what we are pretty good at is understanding why things took place on the basis of the context. So if we think about the context of a loss of half of Britain's combat-ready force at Dunkirk, and we think about that context, suddenly it becomes very difficult to imagine certain outcomes based on that. All right, so 300,000 combat-ready troops led back to Germany to serve as labor.
Yep.
Now we have not quite 300,000 left in the British Isles that were fit to fight. Let's say the Royal Navy suffered even more damage than it did in the English Channel. Mm-hmm. Suddenly those voices in the war cabinet that are quietly pushing for asking Hitler for terms, mm-hmm. suddenly they have a lot more sway. They're the reasonable ones. I guess they were always sort of the reasonable ones, and Churchill wasn't. But the peace party has a lot more sway, and it becomes very easy to imagine the British coming to terms. Then it becomes very hard to imagine the Commonwealth and Empire fighting on, doesn't it? And then we can turn this to Matthew because it becomes very hard to imagine Roosevelt getting the U.S. into the war in Europe from that point on.
Exactly. Matthew, what do you think? I mean, if you have hundreds of thousands of British and French soldiers, prisoners of war, helping to make munitions for the Germans, possibly, I suppose. I guess that would have been against the Geneva Convention. But would the United States have gotten in under those circumstances, do you figure?
Well, now it's time for me to give the terrific disclaimer that John began with, which is,
who knows,
about counterfactuals, as we call them, about going against what we know. But his point about context is very important here. The Americans, of course, the American public opinion, and frankly even the American diplomatic establishment in London, both Ambassador Bullitt and Joseph Kennedy, appeared to be very pessimistic about the future of the British in waging war against Germany before Dunkirk. So the messages coming home are not positive to start with. And the other key point here about the Americans is, you know, the Americans in World War II, Americans in World War II they fight as allies, ultimately forming what they wonderfully call the United Nations, who will fight against the Axis powers. So the Americans would never have been able to wage a war alone against Germany. Never intended to and never could have. That's simply not on the table. There's no even reason for it in 1940. And so when Churchill, and of course Churchill's great bet is that in fact they will join. That they will join, however, with, and this is why I'm so excited about John's book, with the 25% of human population that is in the British Empire, at least putatively. So waging war after an absolute loss in 1940 seems impossible for the Allies to me. And to turn that around, the tremendous stick-to-itiveness that the British will display in the Battle of Britain that follows builds through radio, through Edward Murrow and others, builds an immense affection, sympathy, and begins to change American public opinion, which is resolutely against another European war.
Yeah. Let me play another moment from Churchill's speech to the House of Commons, June 4th, 1940.
Sir, we must be very careful not to assign to this deliverance the attributes of a victory. Wars are not won by evacuations. But there was a victory inside this deliverance, which should be noted.
And of course he does note it. I mean, he goes through the fact that this was a miracle of deliverance. But, as he says, there was plenty of fighting to go, and the outcome, of course, was still very much up in the air. And less than 10 days after Dunkirk, the Germans march into Paris, take control of France. So the stakes are still pretty high for Churchill as he talks to the House of Commons, I guess. John Broich?
They're so high. Again, so we have to use our historical imagination to imagine that everyone thought this war was going to proceed like World War I, with the British fighting shoulder to shoulder with that fabulous French army, and we will send the Germans back over the Rhine, or we'll never let them across in the first place. And now that's all out the window. France as you say, shortly after this, is out of the war. And how do you imagine prosecuting this war without France? They didn't know, and we need to put our imagination in a place where we can't even imagine that.
We should say something about France, and I'm wondering what you think about not just Christopher Nolan's portrayal of the French, which wasn't necessarily unkind, but you've heard some criticism of it, and the French, just that kind of caricature of them being cowards, basically. Matthew Booker, do you want to say something about that?
Well, frankly, this was one of two agendas I took with me into the film.
Yeah.
The first agenda was to see if the director could give us a sense of the individual's sense of abject terror in the face of machine war, and I think he did.
Yeah.
But frankly, that first scene, that opening scene, and I won't give it away for listeners who should see this film, but that opening scene addresses my second agenda item, and that is to rescue and to honor the reputation of French soldiers and the populace in World War II. And I have to say, there's a deep American tradition, deep at least in my lifetime, of dishonoring the French in their military affairs, of disrespecting them, of assuming that Dien Bien Phu, the end of the French adventure in Indochina, that the French inability to preserve their empire, that all of these are signs of a French unwillingness to fight, a general sense of cowardice, and to put this in the terms of my childhood, an effeminacy. And I think those are deeply unfair, unjust, unhistorical, ahistorical, and I was very happy to see the French defending the British in that first scene, the French military.
Let me play.
I agree with that, Matthew. Yeah. That's a terrific scene, and talk about courage. You have to imagine performing that rear guard defense without any real hope, right? And that's courage.
Here's Churchill again. From that speech to the House of Commons, we're getting to that really iconic moment, but this is just the lead up to it.
Sir, I have myself full confidence that if all do their duty, if nothing is neglected, and if the best arrangements are made, as they are being made, we shall prove ourselves once more able to defend our island home, to ride out the storm of war, and to outlive the menace of tyranny, if necessary, for years, if necessary, alone. At any rate, that is what we are going to try to do.
To try to outlive the menace of tyranny, if necessary, alone. But, John, you say Churchill doesn't want to give anyone the opportunity to imagine another outcome other than victory. And clearly, he's hoping they're not going to have to do this alone.
That's right. Matthew said that really well. This is a message for the British people, and it's a message to the American people, and it's a message to Germany. He wants to give nobody even the opportunity to imagine coming to terms. And what he said behind closed doors as well in these days is, if we're invaded, you can't ask people to fight to the death for the sake of getting better peace terms with the Germans. You have to have them imagine if only the options are total success or absolute failure. So it's a message to everybody. It is brilliant. Churchill was a writer.
Yeah.
That's how he earned his money. He was a writer. It's how he came into the public square as well, through his books as a young man, and helped him obviously in politics as well. So he was the right guy for the right time. You know, this romantic writer, pugnacious, you know what?
Right.
We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And if, which I do not for a moment believe, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world, with all its power and might, steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old.
John Broich is an historian at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland. John, thank you very much for being with us today.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
And Matthew Booker teaches history at North Carolina State University in Raleigh. Matthew, thank you.
I enjoyed this very much.
Go to our website, radiowest.org, where you can find links to Broich's articles and an interview with Matthew Booker, along with links to those oral histories we played, some of them anyway, from the Imperial War Museums. It's, again, at radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News, directed today by Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.